Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Experts say Yemen is the worst humanitarian crisis in modern history. Warnings from the UN say the death toll from starvation could reach 18.4 million by the end of the year. Why is this happening and what can be done? We're joined by two experts.
Dr. Charles Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore and the co-author of the Historical Dictionary of Yemen. He served as a past president of the American Institute for Yemeni Studies and is an affiliated scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Hamoud Salhi is a professor and dean of undergraduate studies at California State University at Dominguez Hills. He is also a host of Swana Regional Radio on KPFK in Los Angeles and a frequent media commentator. So welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you back here to talk again about a really sad situation in Yemen. I understand it is potentially the worst famine we've faced in modern history in 100 years, they're saying. I guess the most important place to start is, what is it that we're facing, Hamoud? What's happening in Yemen?
A lot of things are happening in Yemen. There is one on the battleground where the Saudis are continuing to bomb. And this is more devastating than before. There is the humanitarian crisis that is catching up about 75% of the population, and the situation is getting worse and worse. And there is an issue on the back of everybody, perhaps, is the water issue. Some reports many years ago were talking about how Yemen will be the first country to run out of water by 2025. That 2025 is not that far away. So there is a crisis there in addition to the humanitarian things that's happening. Second thing, on the political side, on the region, we've seen some movement since, number one, President Trump gave a warning, or somewhat a warning to the Yemenis and the Saudis to sit down together and work a resolution or a ceasefire, and the meeting was scheduled in Sweden. Well, yesterday we heard that the House declined or rejected the proposal that the Democrats submitted months ago about using the War Powers Act to bring Americans from hostilities area, namely Yemen. So the House is now, the Republicans are against it. They are not going to pursue with that. And this is the same thing would happen in the Senate because the same proposal was there. What was interesting about the proposal in the House is, if it passed, it would have given a chance for the American public to actually hear something, a hearing, or the entire chamber about what's the United States involvement in the region, in Yemen. Now, internationally, there is a movement by the UK Foreign Minister, Jeremy Hunt, who has been pushing to hold the Swedish meeting scheduled to be sort of held by the end of the year. Remember, initially, we had a meeting that was supposed to be scheduled in September in Switzerland. That didn't happen. There were several reasons, but one of them is that the Houthis did not agree to the preconditions that were set according to, I think, United Nations Resolution 2216. One of them was specifically stated that the Houthis must cease hostilities, give up arms, give the equipment to the Saudis and the Yemeni Hadi Mansour government. So there were conditions on them, and in fact, the resolution was biased to that degree. So Jeremy Hunt is very active in building what he wants, what he describes as mutual confidence measures. He has got the Saudis and to agree to allow the Houthis to take some medical evacuation, and that is sort of in line what the Houthis have been asking. There is a discussion about a political solution and another discussion about the humanitarian crisis. What's very interesting is that Sweden has been lobbying since back in April or our march and worked very hard in the United Nations Security Council to organize an event like this, and specifically to address the two issues that seems to be dominating perhaps these negotiations. The last minute, which is very, very important, the last important thing is that, remember, the Saudis and the Emirates are aligned in this conflict. They are against the Houthis, but there is a bit of a change of heart among the Emiratis. The Crown Minister Zayed was in Riyadh 2 days ago, and he met with everyone, about 15 princes and the king, except he didn't meet with Mohammed bin Salman. And that was interpreted as a way of showing that the Emiratis are not happy with the murder of Khashoggi. What's been interesting is that the Emirati medias, which has been sort of supportive, implied support for the Saudis during this visit and after, the media, particularly the Arabic media, start to talk about what they describe as a bad way of handling a crisis in reference to the Khashoggi. So there is a change in the opposition between the Emiratis and the Saudis. So there are a lot of things happening. I don't know what we're going to focus on.
Well, that's actually a good look all the way around. Charles Schmitz, let's bring you in. You and I were talking ahead of the recording about some of these matters as well. What would you add to this?
I would add that the refocus on the humanitarian crisis is because of the battle for Hodeidah. Yemen imports 90% of its food grains, and Hodeidah is the last port that the Houthi control. The UN had pressured the Saudi Emirati-backed forces from going into the city. And when the talk of new negotiations, when the Trump administration and Mattis made clear that they wanted an end to the war by the end of the month, the Saudis and the Emiratis pushed into Hodeidah. They actually took the battle into the city. The concern is, number one, the residents of Hodeidah fleeing, and that's causing the population of Hodeidah is about 700,000 people. Half the city has fled already. There are street battles going on in Hodeidah. And so there's the question of the displaced people, but actually more importantly is the possible destruction of the infrastructure, which is critical for getting supplies to Sana'a, to getting the supplies to the Western Highlands that the Houthi control. Now, just today, the Emirati and the Saudi-backed forces have pulled back, and they're no longer fighting. They appear to have stood down. The second thing I would add to the humanitarian crisis is that the Yemeni economy for the last two decades has been highly dependent upon oil. And during the war period, oil exports have stopped. The Emirati-backed government in the south, the Hadi government, has managed to make just a few recent shipments of oil out. But really, there are no revenues. The revenues available to the Yemeni government are near what they were before. And therefore, the economy has collapsed. And a big part of the humanitarian crisis is simply the fact that people don't have any money. I mean, people haven't been paid for 4 years. And all of the spillover effects on the rest of the economy means that there may be supplies in the market. People don't have the means to buy it. Add to it that the rial has collapsed. I mean, the rial was about 250 to the dollar when the war started, and it's reached 700 now. And that means that the price of everything imported goes way up. So these things, internal displacement, the war in Hodeidah, the collapse of the economy, these are the things that are driving the humanitarian crisis.
I read in some of the news articles that adding to that humanitarian crisis is that some of the bombing targets by the Saudis and its allies were food supply, fish markets and...
I know in particular that some of the grain facilities in the south, in Aden, were hit initially. That was in 2015 when the battle for Aden was going on, that they hit those. And the Saudi campaign did attack basic transportation infrastructure. So they hit bridges on key roads and things like this. That has made it much more difficult to get supplies around. So that is part of the crisis. But I would say that the biggest factor driving the humanitarian crisis is the collapse of the economy and then the issue of displaced people, people that are fleeing the conflict.
Hamoud Salehi, let's bring you back in on this. Now, how did we get to this point Is there a deep history that we need to understand in order to trace to its source why this conflict is even happening and how it's led to this?
There is something about Yemen, just to put it in the context, and this is where we could see the Saudi Arabian role in this. Back in 1981, as an example, when the Gulf Cooperation Council was created, there was a discussion about including Yemen in the council. The current GCC, or Gulf Cooperation Council, is only composed of the monarchies and the emirates, namely the six Gulf countries, not Yemen. At that point, the discussion was that Yemen had a different political system. But there was also concern deeper than that. There was a concern that the Yemeni population was too big for the Saudis to be greater than the GCC. And more than anything else, there is a sense in the Gulf that there is some kind of discrimination against the Yemenis. They were always viewed as less of a national or a nation. They were mistreated. They work as second citizens in all the GCC countries. They are never seen as sort of equal to the GCC. That's the background to this. The second background to this is not the first time that Saudi Arabia is involved in this. The whole Yemen was divided between Marxists in the south, and that led to war, remember, in 1990, and then 96 you had the Union. And that war, it was split between the Marxists in the south and the north, the pro-monarchies. During the Arab nationalist era in the 60s and 50s, the Marxists were supported by Gamal Abdel Nasser, the Arab progressist leaders of the time, the so-called progressists or nationalists, and against the monarchs who were seen as living in the north. Now, the other factor is that Yemen is a society that is rooted in tribalism, and there are huge differences between the city. Everybody is poor, relatively speaking, but there is more differences between the south and the north and within the cities and the rural areas. What is very interesting is that the rural areas were ignored in the 90s and up to early 2000. And the ads at one point, I'm not kidding about this, the ads in eight travel agencies in the 90s used to run as a promotion to their vacations in Yemen an idea or a prospect of being kidnapped by terrorists in Yemen. Now, there was a fact about it, that the Westerners would travel to Yemen and they get kidnapped by authorities there, usually tribalism or somebody. And that kidnapping was used to force the government or the local authorities to build a road, for example, to open schools. And it was through those means, through kidnapping Westerners, that some infrastructure was developed. This is to show the extent to which there is this maldistribution of wealth. Behind the scene of this conflict, yes, there is this economic class differences, tribalism, but there is also a distribution of power, a maldistribution of political power. In the draft of the constitution that was discussed and that rejected by the Houthis, it was clear that the group of Hadi Mansour and backed by the Saudis were going to get the share of the most important powers. The Houthis objected because just of that, they felt that if they are part of this constitution and they are treated equally, they should have equal powers. So there was a pressure to get, for example, certain ministers for them. So there is this historical problems that exist for so many decades. And when you couple with what the Arab Spring happened, or the so-called Arab Spring, and you factor in the Saudi involvement and the Emiratis, and then you factor the Iranians, then Yemen become a center for the Saudis and the Iranians to fight their wars outside their borders. Now, the biggest challenge today is both in Saudi Arabia and in Yemen, they are using external threat to legitimize their action internally. The debate in the Saudi Arabia today is that there is an external threat to the Saudi Arabia, and that diverts the attention away from the internal problems. The killing of Khashoggi, the imprisonment of many Saudi citizens, and Khashoggi is just one example of those. But by creating a place, a conflict outside, projecting the Iranians as a threat, helps them. The same thing with the Iranians. Just a last point, how this is significant. When we look at the debates in the 90s in the Gulf region, when Mohammed Said Khatami was in power and he set a rapprochement policy towards his neighbors, remember during Khatami's era, every Arab GCC state except Yemen had opened up to the Iranians. In fact, Prince Abdullah, the late Prince Abdullah, and Khatami were so close that there was discussion in the media about a Saudi-Iranian pact. The discussion at that time in the Gulf countries was not by the external threat, but the discussion shifted to democratization. So it was during this time that the Qataris started to talk about drafting a constitution. It was during this time that the Emiratis start to form democratic or so-called democratic local legislative elected officials. And the Saudis broadened the council of consultative council. The point is this, when you have no external threat, the shift becomes more to internal politics. What's happening in Yemen and Iran is another, in Yemen, and the fight over the region between the Saudis and Yemenis is an extension of that diversion, of that public attempts to distract us away from the internal problems.
So it sounds really complicated. Charles Schmitz, would you agree with Hamoud's assessment? And would you add anything to that?
Yeah, I would agree. I've been approached by Saudis saying that, well, you know, we have to be involved because the Houthi are threatening us with missiles. And I point out that the Houthi didn't fire any missiles until after the Saudis started bombing. So it was kind of a product of their own aggression in Yemen. And it is very true, as Hamoud says, is that both sides, the Houthi frame their politics around defending Yemen from foreign aggression. And so they've been able to mobilize a much broader constituency because they say they are the ones that are able to maintain Yemen's sovereignty. And the Saudis always point to the very few missiles that the Houthi have shot. They may have gotten Iranian help in developing those capabilities. It's not clear. But the Houthi developed those capabilities precisely to be able to threaten the Saudis. I mean, they have nothing. The Saudis have absolute air superiority in Yemen, and the Houthi have no defense against the bombardment. And so developing the missiles gives the Houthi a card. And I say that, you know, the first step in any resolution of this conflict is going to be a rapprochement between the Saudis and the Houthis in which they come to some agreement over security. And they did this. They did this in the spring of 2016. They got as far even as the Saudis sending some relief supplies directly across the border to the Houthi areas in the north in Saada. But that agreement was scuttled. I believe that agreement was scuttled because Ali Abdullah Saleh was not part of it, and he undermined it. So that, to me, is the key to resolution of the conflict. I might add that, as Hamoud was saying, Yemen is very different than the Gulf states. There are more Yemeni nationals than there are nationals of all the Gulf states put together. And Yemen is very poor, and the Gulf states, of course, are quite wealthy. And so the Saudis, their real goal is to be the most dominant foreign power in Yemen. They see Yemen as a threat. They see Yemen as a threat either as Yemen imploding and poor Yemenis pouring across the border, or Yemen imploding and terrorist organizations, Al-Qaeda, using, and they have used Yemen as a base to come and attack Saudi Arabia. Or they're also afraid of a strong Yemen. They're afraid of a Yemen united, a strong state that could represent a threat to Saudi Arabia as well. And so what Saudi Arabia would like is kind of a Yemeni state that's halfway, that can maintain the internal control, that can provide enough growth so that people are relatively satisfied, yet won't be strong enough to actually threaten the Saudis themselves. And so the Saudis want to be the most dominant foreign power in Yemen. They don't want any other foreign power meddling in Yemen. And so the fact that the Iranians have some role, as small as it may be, but just the fact that the Houthi are talking to the Iranians, this is the threat. Let me say that the real threat for the Saudis is not so much the Iranians, it is that the Houthi are independent. And once the Houthi can come into conversation with the Saudis and deal with them, which they can do, I have no doubt they can do that, then this conflict will start to stand down.
You know, it's interesting, Charles Schmitz, that you mentioned that the Saudis don't want Yemen to implode. And yet it seems like that's exactly what's happening with the Saudi push.
That's a good point. My understanding is that the Americans were not happy at all with, they were aware that the Saudis were preparing this campaign, but they were not happy with it because they felt that it was ill-prepared, it was ill-planned, and it would not reach its objectives. In other words, the Saudis, I think, believed that, you know, their air campaign would, in a matter of months, even weeks, would bring the Houthi to their knees and change the equation. And it just didn't. And, you know, most outsiders said that it wouldn't as well. I mean, the Houthi fought 6 years of insurgency against the Yemeni government. So they're very experienced as insurgents. In fact, that's their best position, is to be the underdogs in a battle. They know how to do that quite well. And so, in effect, the Saudis have reinforced what are the Houthis' best attributes or their best capabilities. So, yes, it is in a way backfiring, but that's because it was an ill-conceived plan. And to connect that back to bin Salman, he staked his reputation on this. This is the first time that the Saudis used the military to this extent. I mean, they did use it in their military in Yemen in 2009, very little, minimally. They used their military in Bahrain in 2011 to crush the Arab Spring there. But this is the first sort of large-scale Saudi involvement, and it's going badly, and it's making bin Salman look bad as well.
So you started to talk about what it would require to resolve this crisis before tens of millions more people die. What do you propose?
Well, the first thing that needs to happen is the Saudis and the Houthi need to reach a security agreement. And this would involve an ending of the bombardment and an ending of the missile attacks. And those two cards, one for the other, that would assure the Saudis, and it would bring the Houthi into negotiations. The next step after that is the rest of Yemen, because the southern, eastern, and now in the Hodeidah region, these are regions that are under Emirati, and they're nominally under the Hadi government. And those are all Yemenis that are opposed to the Houthi. And then there needs to be an agreement between them and the Houthi to create a political process to move forward. And what has been said again and again and again is that there needs to be a government of national reconciliation in which Hadi is out. In other words, Hadi has been the representative of one side, and the Houthi would have representation in this government, but it wouldn't be a Houthi government. It would be a national reconciliation government. And that government could begin to see de-escalation within the country and provide a political means forward with some kind of elections or something like that. A sticking point is the Constitution. As Hamoud said, the Constitution calls for a federal division of Yemen into six districts. Both the Houthis and the Southerners reject those divisions. They feel that those divisions were created precisely to harm their interests. And so there's going to have to be a renegotiation of that document. But that could be done under the National Reconciliation Government.
Well, that sounds like there's possibility of resolution. Hamoud, are you optimistic?
It's really hard to say. On the one hand, yes. And maybe that's my natural optimism. The other thing is that I think what you've been seeing is you have an interest by its outside powers, namely the involvement of the United Kingdom, the United States to a degree. We still have to figure that out, and international public pressure. I feel this has to lead somewhere. There is a possibility that a settlement or resolution, at least partially in transition, could be worked out. I am tempted say that the meeting in Sweden could be key, in particular because of the role of the major powers. And here again, this is not a call to add a new United Nations Security Council resolutions. But I think part of it, there is a sense, particularly from the Saudis that, and the Emiratis, that perhaps it's time to get out from this conflict and find a resolution. But does that mean that we are going to have the proper deal? I think we are not going to have the proper deal because the Houthis will not settle for a resolution that will not be sort of acceptable to them in ways that they appear or become, they lose leverage on anything of the sort that would not make them in a better or at least the peace is appealing. They are not going to give up for anything. The Saudis at the same time, the Saudis has a lot to lose in this case, and the Emiratis as well, in part because there is the image of Saudi Arabia. There is also the military cost that this conflict is costing them. And then the reputation or the role in the whole Arab world. The discussion in the Arab world today is focusing more on the Saudis being more of a player or a country that is promoting a policy that is in line with Israel, that is in line with the United States and anti the Arab people. This change of language or narrative has a very, very important impact in the psyche in Saudi Arabia. And related to that is that there is, I think at one point or another, the older leadership in Saudi Arabia and the Arab Emirates will step in. What we've seen is that this is a new generation that is sort of not politically savvy. Mohammed Salman is in his early 30s. Abdullah bin Zayed, I think foreign minister or one of the leader in the United Arab Emirates, who is behind foreign policy, is in his mid-30s. And, you know, the Crown Prince, Zayed in his early 30s, even Mohammed, the leader of Dubai and the first minister of the UAE, is in his 40s. We lost that old liberation, old leadership, Faisal or Zayed and Nahyan. That leadership used to think strategically. They were interested in the Arab Brotherhood. And I think this leadership, this young leadership who is becoming stronger and stronger and just thinks that doesn't appeal to the vast majority of or the tradition in this region, may see itself creating a problem for their longevity. And what we've seen with how Mohammed bin Salman is acting, the imprisonment or taking people in a hotel and making them do things that, come up with a bribe, give them money or anything to combat what you call it, a bribery or being a transparent, all of those kind of things, doesn't bode well with the Saudi or the Gulf countries. These are secret societies that prepare to keep their internal conflicts inside rather than outside. The Yemen seems to put that sort of in the open. When you look at the foreign policy of United Arab Emirates prior to this case, they were the quietest, the more rational, the stable. Now the United Arab Emirates is meeting with the Israelis, they are in other countries, invading other countries specifically, that doesn't go well with the leadership, the nationals in this country. So that's why I am optimistic, because it's as if these leaders are experiencing what it takes to take actions that are in line with the tradition or what has been sort of accustomed. One would hope that there would be a solution. And I think this Sweden meeting is a good opportunity to set a path for how perhaps de-escalate the conflict or put a path for peace. And all the discussion, I think, at this point is leaning toward that path. Whether it's successful or not, it certainly will be a long road and it will take a long time.
Well, thank you so much, Hamoud Salhi and Charles Schmitz. It's been a great pleasure hosting you. I really appreciate your wisdom on this and sharing your research. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Dr. Charles Schmitz is a professor of geography at Towson University in Baltimore and the co-author of the Historical Dictionary of Yemen. He served as a past president of the American Institute for Yemeni Studies and is an affiliated scholar with the Middle East Institute in Washington, D.C. Hamoud Salhi is a professor and dean of undergraduate studies at California State University at Dominguez Hills. He is also a host of Swana Regional Radio on KPFK in Los Angeles and a frequent media commentator.